Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
Neil McDonough is such a awful, horrible human being. God, no.
Right.
No.
Right. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You can let it out on this on the podcast.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It is director and co-writer of a movie called Apex, Edward Drake. Is here to talk with us about that. The movie is in theaters, VOD, and digital on November 12th. Edward, welcome.
Thank you, Chris and Jonathan. Pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast. Love the episode that you guys did with Richard Kelly on Donnie Darko.
Oh, yeah, man. He was a great guest. You never know what you're going to get a lot of times. Somebody who's made something that famous.
Yep,
and everything, and he was absolutely a joy to talk to, and I'm glad that you like our podcast and everything. So, yeah, that's I love to hear that. I love to hear good things about us. I know that there are. I mean, you know, I know that there's a direct inspiration for Apex, but tell me what your inspiration was for this movie.
I wanted to make a movie where I could get Mr. Willis to say, "I'm eggs and bacon on a Sunday morning."
It's what it seemed like to me. It seemed like a very standout line in that in this movie to me.
Yeah, I'm only half joking there. I was around with Corey, and he and I were just having a chat about what was up next. We were wondering what is a story that could be shot safely during COVID. We were one of the first productions back after the lockdowns were lifted. And so we were, it was the Wild West. There were no vaccines back then. We were just walking through everything. And it was a really interesting and amazing way to create a film, because I'm very much aware of the world in which we're making and telling these kinds of stories at the moment. And art is not made in a vacuum, and nor is it consumed in a vacuum. So you have to be aware of the legacy of the audience and the actors, and you know what roles they've played in the past, and how the audience is going to bring their preconceived ideas to a story like this. And also, how do you make a movie in the middle of a pandemic?
Right.
So I wrote it for like in a way that we could shoot predominantly outdoors, that actors would have limited physical contact with each other. Bruce never had to come into contact with another actor. We shot Bruce in Washington. We shot the rest of the film in Victoria, BC.
Oh, wow. Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. And
I was actually wondering about that, because it seemed like some of these scenes, it just seemed like there were moments where you had to, cut in another actor to, it's not like you can just totally tell. It's just that I wondered if that's what you did.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very okay with people seeing the seams of a film like this, because we created a lot. We actually wrote a white paper that Workplace BC ended up taking large like slabs of our language and putting it in their own official white paper. We were creating the methods to bring people back to work. We were the canary in the coal mine. We were under a lot of scrutiny when we were doing this. It was an 8-day shoot over two countries.
Wow.
It was a yeah, it was a lot of fun. I'm so grateful to Corey and to the cast and crew for their support. And I'm very grateful.
Yeah, there's obviously the biggest comparison would be, you know, that classic The Most Dangerous Game, and then, you know, if you grew up in a certain time like Jonathan and I did, Surviving the Game, which came out in 1994, I think. There are other elements to this too, like The Running Man and Hostel, yep, that pop up in my head while I was watching this. Anything else that may have inspired this movie?
Gladiator. I love Gladiator because it gives us such a glimpse into the mindset of Commodus, and that's just, that to me is what I live for. It's getting inside the heads of these like despicable characters. The hunters were the most interesting part of the story for me in like every single way. So I was definitely drawn to the idea of what brings someone to an island to go and hunt another human being. And also playing with the audience's understanding that as soon as the audience knew that they were hunting Bruce Willis, well, guess what? Bruce ain't going to die in this movie. And so subverting what makes him strong, because Bruce is a cheeky action hero. He's not the strongest. He's not the fastest. He's not like, you know, he's a guy that will go to the mat for what he believes in, and he'll bring the audience along in an everyman kind of way. And I wanted to play with that idea. And I think that's what's speaking to a lot of audiences, that they can see this relatability to Malone that isn't likable per se, but it's compelling because he's using mind games and he's just taking advantage of old grudges between these hunters to stay alive and create distractions that bring people in and all this other stuff. And there's definitely a video game element to it, but I think that, you know, where you're blind if you don't understand that a lot of younger audiences, they're playing so many video games. They're fluent in video game language just as much as they are cinema language. So,
I was going to ask about this because the movie has a lot to do with has a lot to say about, like, sort of, I guess, an ego run amok. People who compare their worth in literal dollars, and by the way, glad to see Lachlan Monroe in this movie. And yeah, he's had a long career, but he stole a couple of movies early on in the 90s, and I love seeing him in this. But you have the hunters can't even trust each other and they pose threats to each other. So what went into that decision? Like, what, you know, you could have made this Bruce Willis versus the world if you wanted to, but you really sort of kind of made this almost free for all, even though it's not really, that's not really what the parameters of the game is. So yeah, what went into that decision? Why did you go that way?
I wanted to create a story that was about, the way in which idiots try and pick a fight with Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
It's just the biggest mistake you can make of all time.
Right.
It was crazy. So I just thought that, look, Neil McDonough and Lachlan Monroe, they're mates in real life. And
oh, really?
Yeah. Their sons play on the same basketball team, or not basketball, baseball team. And they had a great dynamic and chemistry that I was able to play on as well. Like, there's a natural competitiveness among these hunters. And, you know, Monroe is just so much fun. I just got stuck with him for 2 days in Dallas. My flights got canceled. So we were just hanging out at the same hotel. And he's the most professional actor out there. He is such a gem. There's a reason why, you know, his work for Clint Eastwood, Robert Redford, Bill Bixby. He is such a legend. And he's just a good presence on set. He understands blocking better than any other actor I know. He can he can look at a script and he can see the location and he can immediately, like, his instincts are so phenomenally on point. He can see exactly how the script is going to translate to this real world location. And he's always down to throw out ideas and what about this and what about that. And I love that. I love that energy.
Yeah, I certainly want to get into the casting because, you know, first off, you're two top stars. I really want to know what it's like working with them. Bruce Willis and Neil McDonough. Yeah. Bruce Willis, of course, has had, you know, a world famous career. Neil McDonough, huge character actor who's been in a million things, and he's always I think he's always great in everything that he's in.
Yep.
Tell me what it's like working with those two guys.
Neil McDonough is such a awful, horrible human being. God knows.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You can let it out on the podcast.
Dude, he's such a giving performer, and he brings this natural trust and confidence that when he speaks, when he enters the room in a scene, everyone stands up a little bit straighter, and it's so rare for an actor to have that quality. Like Timothy V. Murphy, he's another actor who has that just quiet confidence that he knows his art, he knows how to work, and he's going to step up and crush it every time. So, yeah, I think that there's a and again, Bruce has been nothing but kind to me. I'm so grateful for his trust and his friendship, and we have a lot of fun. He honestly, I think it was one of his favorite days on set ever when we were shooting Apex, because we were out in nature. He was eating wild berries straight off the vine. We lost Bruce Willis for about 20 minutes. I kid you not. On set, there was private security, there was his team, there was everyone. And it was one of the first setups of the first scenes for the film, and no one could find Bruce. And everyone went into a panic mode. It was like, okay, we need to do a grid search of the property right now. Let's call the National Guard. We need helicopters. Where are the sniffer dogs? Get me, and then my best friend, Francis Cronin, he was with me on set, and he's ex-Irish Army. And so he quietly just dipped away from the commotion, and he found Bruce, and Bruce had wandered off the property we were shooting on. Just walked behind a hedge. He was no more than 200 meters away from where everyone was having this meltdown. And he just found some wild berries on the vine. And instead of disturbing him, Frank ran back to me and was like, "You're never going to believe this. He's just gone for a little walk and he's having the time of his life." And so I went, I picked up the camera, and the scenes that you see of Bruce eating berries are just Bruce eating berries.
So you added that because he went off on this little
Little walk.
That's amazing. And then you even got in, you know, you even have the sort of the game master come in and say, "You're going to start tripping balls and all this."
Yeah. He also had like his own little eating berries score, which I thought was really fun.
Yeah, we wanted In the Summertime by Mungo Jerry, but we couldn't get clearance for it, so we just wanted something that was true to the original pitch, which is Predator meets Mr. Magoo.
I think you nailed it.
So the berry stuff, I just made that up on the fly because I needed we shot Bruce on the first day of filming, and we shot Alexia Fast as West, the hologram. She was the very final thing we shot. And so what I do after every day that I work with Bruce is I look through my notes and I rejig the dialogue or blocking or action in the script to correlate with what natural gems he just throws out. So every now and then he'll just improv just something that could not possibly be written. And it's so much fun. And it's a lot of films waste those moments because they just don't, they don't have the flexibility to just adapt on the fly and be like, oh, how can we make this little piece of genius that we got on camera? How can we make that work for us? Mm-hmm. And that's such a gift. That's what I live for. When there's a, yeah, when there's a little moment that you're just, that you can't make up, that's truthful. And usually it's what makes a lot of these films memorable.
Yeah. He is mentioned a few of the bigger names. What about the rest of your cast? How did you end up getting them in the movie, and what was like working with them?
Nels Lennison is a very good friend of mine. Corey, mm-hmm. of course, we built a character for Corey that would allow him to be an anchor of humanity mm-hmm. for these killers. And we wanted I think what spoke to the cast was the idea that every hunter was drawn to the island for a different personal reason. Mm-hmm. And there's a version of this story where it's just like, great, six guys, rich, whatever, pick up guns, go hunt Bruce Willis. What I really wanted to do was my dinner with Andre, but my dinner with Apex. And
okay.
The psychology of why do you want to go and hunt a human being is mm-hmm. just as important as the way in which you're going about hunting another human.
Yeah.
That was a really fun glimpse into the minds of these characters. And I think the cast were able to see that they were going to get to work with some good people. Megan Peter Hill as Jezza was so much mm-hmm. fun. Megan's one of my favorite human beings. And I was mm-hmm. so happy when, you know, the script spoke to her, and her scene with Nels as Bishop during the landmine scene. So that was one of the first things I wrote. And I fought to keep that in because it is a bit long on the page, but mm-hmm. I knew that once it got up on its legs, and I knew that with Nels and Megan playing off each other, there would be a fantastic dynamic. And
yeah.
And it ends with a bang.
it does.
So yeah, very grateful. And then Trevor Gretzky as well. I got to give a shout out to Trevor because I met Trevor on the set of Cosmic Sin, where we had 20 minutes to shoot the opening scene of that film. And his instincts were just so on point. And after that little, like we shot his little scene, and then we were having a chat out afterwards, and I said, dude, I really hope we can work together again soon. Your instincts are so on point. You knew exactly how to play to the camera. You took direction incredibly. And seeing him grow from Cosmic Sin to Apex, and then he has a great, great turn in a little film called American Siege. And I'm so proud of that dude. He has he's a great guy, and I wish him nothing but the best. And as an actor, he's just going from strength to strength.
So was there any intention in the way his character was constructed as kind of being someone that, you know, is in the, I mean, his character in the movie is someone that you may get the impression he's kind of living in the shadow of his father.
That was not intentional, but it was definitely a truth that he could play into. Now that's not true in real life.
I understand in real life, but I just the fact that he has like a famous dad, I just remember that popped in my head. I've known about him for a while just because I'm a Chicago Cubs fan, and he was drafted by them.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. He was a really good baseball player.
Oh, he was cute. Yeah. He was cute. He was definitely able to play into the idea of that because it's something that has been around the conversation of his relationship with his own father for a long time. So, and that's fantastic. Anytime I can bring the actor's real inner world, their inner truth closer to the character, that's where the magic happens because there's only so much time we have on these sets. This was an 8-day shoot and I needed to be able to play to instincts more than we could create these like new characters that are just born whole cloth sort of a thing. And look, Trevor never dropped a line, always hit his mark and looked good doing it. And so there's nothing, that's pretty much 90% of an actor's challenge. The other 10% is finding that magic and making it, why are they cast? Why are they the person that is bringing this character to life? But yeah, very happy.
I want to rewind to when you first started talking about him. Did you say you had 20 minutes to do the opening scene?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was a hell of a thing. Yeah.
We're talking about Cosmic Sin here, right? The,
yeah.
20 minutes. What were the circumstances for that?
I had a line producer that was threatening to kill me if I went over. So
no.
Oh yeah. Well, shout out to Joe. yeah, it's amazing how a couple little of death threats can really motivate you to get your scene.
Oh yeah.
So Cosmic Sin was a 17-day shoot that got halved because of COVID. And we found out 2 days before that the lockdown was going to hit. And so I had to make a story out of the footage that was already shot plus the 2 days that were that we had coming up. And so that will always be, I am still writing Cosmic Sin in my head. And that is there is so much that we wanted to do with that story that it just, the universe conspired and it was not the right time to tell that story. I'm so proud of the effort of, our amazing production designer, David Dean Ebert. He had a packet of peanuts and, a neon highlighter, and he made that set come to life. Brandon Cox, our great DP, we were under the gun from day one. The fact that the film got made in the first place is a small miracle. I wish we could have brought to life what was on the page. But you know what? Live and learn. And I'm grateful to the financiers, to Bondit, to Buffalo 8 and for Corey for their continued trust and faith that we can tell some pretty cool stories.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You must feel like an accidental Ed Wood making a movie like that, right? Where it's like, you do a scene and something's just not quite right, but you're like, whatever. People get over it. They know what they're watching, and then you move on to the next thing, type of thing. I mean, it must be. I mean, anybody who's seen Living in Oblivion knows this. Indie film world has got to be kind of crazy sometimes, but also maybe exhilarating sometimes too.
Yeah, when your back is up against the wall, there is definitely an adrenaline rush that comes with writing your way out of a corner. I live to write. I wake up early every day so that I can get a few hours of just writing before LA wakes up. Writing is how I communicate with the world and understand myself and all that good stuff. So yes, there is a rush that comes with, like, suddenly our 20-day shoot is now a 10-day shoot, and now we have to double Southern Georgia for Los Angeles.
It's the same. What are you talking about?
That is definitely tough. Having been around Southern Georgia, I don't know how you would have done it, but I guess you tell people that it's California, and you let your mind, you let your imagination run the rest. So,
well, the film I'm referencing is called Gasoline Alley, and when you have actors like Luke Wilson and especially Devon Sawa, who can be so trusting and convincing, and they're not winking at the audience. In Devon's case, when he believes he's in Los Angeles and you're seeing that, it's so compelling. And yeah, it's hard to, he does so much of the believe, he brings so much believability to that character and to that world. And then you, again, you pick your battles. We're not shooting cow fields and saying that it's, Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I was going to say, man, Carpenter got away calling getting California look like Illinois. He still had palm trees in there. So, I mean.
There's a fun challenge to this world, and I'm very grateful for the opportunities.
Mm-hmm. I love this one scene that you have in Apex where, the hologram is telling all the hunters who Bruce Willis is and everything. I am assuming that a lot of the things that he survives in this are references to his other movies. Am I correct on that?
No, of course. Where would you get that idea from?
It's funny because it lulled me into this, this false. You always hear the bio of the of the badass in the movies, and you're just like, okay, well here's what he did. He was in Vietnam, and he's got 37 kills under his belt and all that. You're expecting that. But when I heard fell out of a building and survived it or something like that, and then especially survived that train crash, like we're all supposed to know what the train crash is, I was like, he's referencing that's a nice touch. Can you name the references?
Oh yeah, I mean, that scene originally went for about 4 minutes, and mm-hmm. Alexia Fast, who plays West, she hadn't seen 90% of the movies, so she had no
really
idea knowing it. So that's why her delivery is so natural and like emotionless. It's like, mm-hmm. yes, this man is a badass. He has, overcome these incredible obstacles. the one that tripped her up, that had her asking questions, was he was the sole survivor after flying a NASA shuttle into an asteroid and saving the world. And she pulls me aside and she's like, could you really survive that? And I was like, well, Bruce can. And she's like, great. Yep.
Bruce can and has. No, that was a nice touch because, like I said, it's one of those where it's that point in the movie where you just like, okay, well, this is all his badass characteristics. And then like halfway through it, you're like, wait a minute, this might be kind of a jokey thing. I like that.
To be fair to her though, we all had that same question in the summer of 1997 or 98. So,
Don't want to close my eyes.
You've mentioned the broad places where you shot this. Could you name specifically, and what was it like shooting there in those locations?
Yeah, we shot for 2 days in Blaine, Washington, which mm-hmm. is about 20 minutes from the Canada-US border. And then we shot for 6 days in Victoria, BC, which is a mm-hmm. ferry ride away from Vancouver. And geographically, they might be separated by, the Canada-US border, but mm-hmm. Ecologically, they are incredibly similar. So mm-hmm. that's why a lot of our scenes, we were able to turn around, and it's a lot of the same flora, fauna, the bird sounds are the same.
Mm-hmm.
The energy is the same. The only tricky thing, one of the trickier things was that in the time that we went from, so we shot Bruce's 2 days, then we went down for 14 days for quarantine, and then we came back up in BC. And in those 14 days, the wildfires in Oregon had got out of control. So we had this natural haze that came through. Mm-hmm. And that was unexpected, and there was nothing we could do about it. So what I did is I rejigged the blocking mentally to suggest that Bruce was at a higher elevation sometimes and looking down. So there was cloud cover, there was stuff. And I think, no one, as soon as people find out that it was shot in two different countries and that Bruce never really interacted with another actor, people there's a lot of faith and a lot of trust you can build by telling the audience, this is what is happening, this is it. And then the movie magic comes in just knowing when to push the boundaries and knowing, you know, what shortcuts will really damage the film and break the believability and that sort of a thing.
It's interesting because Jonathan asked me, was there ever a scene in there where Bruce Willis interacted with another actor? And I was like, well, I don't know. I thought he did. I thought he was with McDonough in one scene, but maybe not. Maybe it's the, you know, maybe it's the, you know, cut in such a certain way or whatever. So we were having that discussion. You know, at least it's a, you know, it's enough to make you believe that they're in the same scene. So I came out thinking they at least did the one. So
yeah. And I mean, I figured there was, you know, COVID reasons and, you know, stuff like that, that would, you know, keep the actor separate. I was shocked when you told me you shot in two different locations, though, because that I wouldn't have known. I assumed you were always in the same place. So definitely that was.
Yeah, it came with its own challenges. But again, we made it work for us. Like, yeah. More we can, I think as filmmakers, we are naturally resistant to the geography of certain locations. A lot of friends that I have, you know, will eliminate a great location because it doesn't fit with the script. Well, guess what? If you've got a great location, it's available, it worked for production, have a look at the script and see if it can't work for you as well. Because I promise, every time you get a problem and you dig deeper into the story, everything will be rewarded for it. That's where the magic comes out.
Mm-hmm.
I
don't know if you bothered to sketch this out, but what's the world like outside of this island? Because there's a futuristic element to this, mm-hmm. where people are being transported just like at Star Trek to the island. There's a lot of hologram imagery in it. But when people are getting called, from other places, it looks like, you know, life as usual, but there's obviously I would say it's not a not too distant future feel to this. Could you describe what the world is like outside?
Yeah, I wanted to create a world where inequality was like running wild, essentially. And to teleport was something that was only restricted to the upper echelons and the elite. And mm-hmm. so it's cheaper to transport people with a flying helicopter. All helicopters fly. I don't know why I said that. But to transport a shipping crate with a helicopter than it just teleport someone there.
Mm-hmm.
I always look at like photos of the 1920s, and there are such clear parallels between like modern day life and, you know, even going back to the 19th, 20th century. Like, if you think that, you know, everyone had a horse back then, well, everyone has a car now. And the mm-hmm. way that we talk about cars is probably the way that they were talking about horses back then. The way we communicate as well. I always find it funny when older generations say, oh, everyone's just got their head in their phones all the time. If you look at photos of people in transit, you know, everyone's reading a book or a newspaper.
Yeah.
There's always parallels and nice little analogies that we can play on. And I just thought it felt truthful that, yeah, we're still probably going to have phones. We're still going to have smartwatches. These are things that are tactile and functional, and they work now, and they will serve a purpose moving forward.
Yeah.
And then I reference a war as well. And there's a sequel to Apex that's in the works at the moment, which looks at how that war was able to create this generation of very wealthy individuals that needed to satiate the urges that were created from that war. And a lot of the the violent tendencies that we see in the rich and the wealthy are born from conflict and from surviving conflict, because once you've tasted those heights of, you know, life and death, everything seems to pale in comparison in some regard.
We would like to thank Edward Drake for coming in and giving us his time. The movie is Apex. It comes out in theaters, VOD, and digital November 12th. Edward, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Chris, Jonathan, stay awesome. Yeah, have a great time, and I'll speak to you soon.
All right, that's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
And apparently we have another 10 minutes, but Jesus Christ, let it end, please. No. Yeah, what, have you guys seen Dune yet?
I have not seen it all the way yet. I intend to see it in the next few days, actually. I was started watching it on HBO Max, and then I had my brother wanted to see it, and I was like, well, I might watch it with him, so.
Nice.
I've seen it, yes.
Yeah. What does it feel like, one story, or is it definitely something that's set up for two stories, like a sequel?
It's definitely set up for a sequel.
The question is, I guess, is even if it did as well as it did, how many people from that original viewing want to see the next installment? I guess that would be the next question.
Yeah, it's weird, like, because, I mean, you've had movies like that before, like, you know, you knew Kill Bill was Kill Bill Volume 1, and you know, It Chapter 1, that kind of thing. But I don't know, this one felt different. Like, it really, like, it doesn't really have an ending. It's really weird. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah. I think with something like Kill Bill,
yeah,
it's a complete story. I actually saw Kill Bill Volume 2 before I saw Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yeah.
By sheer mistake, because I was not old enough to go and see the movies. So I stole a copy from Blockbuster, and I didn't know which one I picked up, and it was Volume 2. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to go and, like, give it back. So I watched Volume 2, and I could understand everything that was going on. And then my experience of Volume 2 was enriched by what I saw in Volume 1. So I feel like, with feature films, what differentiates a feature film from TV is that we get closure to a large extent. We want like an emotional, like, cathartic release, if that's even a thing.
Cathartic
release. Yeah. I'm trying to twist the word to express what I mean.
Right.
That's the difference for me between features and TV.
No, I think you're right. Like, the film itself by itself has to work on its own as its own thing, whereas, like, an episode of a television show probably needs other episodes. I mean, depending on the type of show it is. But yeah, no, I know what you're saying.
Well, yeah. It's like you watch Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Volume 1 or Part 1, and it's like, oh, well, that was just the first act of a movie, of one big movie.
Yeah, that's kind of what Dune's like. That's a good comparison to what Dune's like.
One of the best TV shows I've seen, God, I think it's one of the best stories ever committed to film, is Midnight Mass by Mike Flanagan.
I just started watching that the other day, and I'm looking forward to finishing it. Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, I was raised in a Jesuit environment. I went to a Jesuit high school. And I, you know, like, came of age in a time where America was wrestling with its spirituality in a really interesting way. And what Mike Flanagan does is he looks at what it means to have had this upbringing, and what that means to walk through the world with this worldview. But he tied up every loose end. This story, it's a complete story, and I love that. I know we have to sell subscription services to the Netflix and HBO and keep people on the hook, and, you know, cliffhangers have existed ever since Charles Dickens literally had a character hanging off a cliff, and there's ways that we can, you know, tell these stories in in that way to keep you wanting more. But there's just something about a great feature film is something that gives the audience a moment to breathe from the real world and disappear into another world. And yeah, I really admire that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Which isn't to say that I won't love Dune, because I would.
Hey, no, it's still really good. Like, I'm not, I definitely liked it. The you know, Denis great with world building. And I mean, he nails it in a way that I don't think Lynch was able to quite get a grasp on. That probably wasn't all Lynch's fault, but Denis has a better handle on it, I think.
My final thing I was going to say is Hyperion, the Dan Simmons novel. Looks like Bradley Cooper has finally set it up over at Warner Brothers, and that is such a seminal sci-fi text. That is incredible. I can't wait to see what they do with that.
Yeah, and that'll be a good one too, because I don't think that's not one we really talk about anymore. So it'll bring that to people's attention, I think, which will be really cool, because that is a really good. I love Simmons. So,
have you ever read the Red Rising trilogy? Or by there's five. No. There's actually five in the series now. They are incredible. To be redundant, it's Game of Thrones in space.
But oh, really?
It is incredible. Some of the visuals, it's by an author called Pierce Brown, and book five has some of the like grandest, most epic writing since Dante's Inferno. It's incredible stuff. I urge anyone to check it out. And it's kind of.
Sounds like I have a bunch now on my reading list, in addition to all the stuff that I'm supposed to watch as well. So thanks for that. That's amazing.